Joseph Bologna was born in 1745 in the French West Indies on a plantation on the island of Guadeloupe.
Black slaves in Saint-Domingue in Haiti, and presumably also in Guadeloupe, were forced to wear masks when they were picking sugarcane in the fields.
That's journalist Andrea Valentino.
Because if they didn't wear the masks, they were so hungry that they would try and eat the sugarcane. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
That might have been Joseph's lot, but it wasn't, thanks in part to an opportunity to master a sport. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
The early life of Joseph Bologna was full of all kinds of possibility.
His father was a rich plantation owner, and his mother was Nanon, a black slave.
Nanon was said to be the most beautiful woman in the French West Indies.
He owes a lot to Mama.
That's researcher and historian Mario Valdez.
Both her color and his damn good looks.
Joseph's father was a minor nobleman named Georges Bologna de Saint-Georges. Most plantation owners would have disavowed their mistresses and illegitimate children, but Bologna did not. France's Code Noir, or Black Code, imposed harsh restrictions on freedom of religion, marriage, and commerce for black slaves and non-slaves living in the colonies. So when Joseph was 7 years old, his father took Nanon and their son to France.
He enjoyed many of the privileges that a white, upper-class French person would have enjoyed in the 18th century, and that he had a good education. He was well off. They lived in Saint-Germain, which was and still is a nice part of Paris.
I'm sure people would have gawked at him because he was so good-looking. He was well-dressed and very gentlemanly, and I'm sure everyone was quite delighted with him.
But at the same time, there was this undercurrent of racism everywhere he went.
When they arrived in France, they found that Le Code Noir wasn't limited to the French colonies.
That required every black person in Paris to register with the police.
Joseph and Nanon did that. Georges Bologna's money and title helped shield them from some of the other effects of Le Code Noir. But it wasn't until Joseph took up a sport that things began looking up. At school, Joseph Bologna studied math and history in the morning.
And in the afternoon, he fenced.
At the age of 13, Joseph enrolled in the Royal Polytechnic Academy of Weapons and Riding. His teacher was Nicolas Tessier de la Boissière, a master swordsman and a huge figure in the development of modern fencing.
Fencing was really a way in which people could make their way in society.
The sword was everything. If you were not a good swordsman, you need not come to dinner.
In just a year or two, Joseph Bologna became an expert fencer. He began to compete against the best swordsmen of Europe. One of his most celebrated contests was against fencing master Alexander Picard, who had publicly called Joseph La Boissière's mulatto. That was a heavily loaded term, even in the 18th century. With pro-slavery and abolitionist spectators looking on and wagering, Joseph won the match.
And his father was so pleased with him for having won this fencing match that he gifted him with a horse and a carriage that he used to drive around Paris, like the creme de la creme of Parisian society.
But Joseph excelled at more than fencing.
Boxing. There's an image of him boxing.
He famously could swim across the Seine with one arm tied behind his back.
He was a good runner. He's a good ice skater.
Shooting. One account says that he was the best marksman in Europe.
The United States ambassador to France and future U.S. president John Adams wrote in his diary,
"He will hit the button, any button, on the coat or waistcoat of the greatest masters. He will hit a crown piece in the air with a pistol ball."
His dancing ability, along with his good looks and charm, made him a hit in the sophisticated salons of Paris.
And I suppose because he was unusual as a black person in Paris, people were curious about him, and women in particular were keen to dance with him.
Joseph Bologna danced and fenced his way into the hearts of French nobility. He graduated from the Royal Academy in 1766 and was made an officer in the court of King Louis XV. He was henceforth known as Le Chevalier de Saint-Georges. That title brought new connections and patronage, which he used to pursue a career in music. In 1769, he began playing violin in the Concert d'Amateurs. Despite what its name might suggest, the group was made up of the finest musicians from the region.
His playing must have been very, very good.
That's concert violinist Jean Lamont, director emerita of Tuffle Music, a Baroque orchestra based in Toronto.
There's something about bow technique and fencing that have something in common that he obviously had an amazing skill for.
By 1773, Le Chevalier was director of the Concert des Amateurs. Parisians flocked to concert halls to hear the virtuoso soloist and the music he composed.
And those are pieces that feature the violin, and the parts he wrote for the violin are very difficult.
That's Tuffle Music Orchestra and soloist Linda Melsted, under the direction of Jean Lamont, playing Le Chevalier's Violin Concerto in D major.
Sometimes you find with composers who are also performers or players that they write virtuosic things to show off, and that when they try to write slow movements of music, there seems to be no depth. What I loved about Saint-Georges' music is that as difficult and virtuosic as his fast pieces are, the slow ones are very, very tender and intimate. There's a very touching sadness to the slow parts that I find show that there was some depth to this guy. He was Marie Antoinette's music teacher for a while and then was fired from that job because they got too close. I'm using air quotes there.
But the Queen of France remained a supporter. She attended Le Chevalier's concerts, sometimes unannounced. She accompanied him on piano at private performances. In 1776, when the Paris Opera needed a new director,
she put his name forward to the king, who was then Louis XVI. And the king wanted to please Marie Antoinette, and the king was entirely in favor.
But two singers and a dancer from the Paris Opera petitioned the queen. They said,
"Their honor and the delicacy of their conscience would not permit them ever to be subjected to the orders of a mulatto. Rather than someone else get the job, Louis XVI decided to give it to no one."
But music continued to be the center of Le Chevalier's life over the next decade and a half. He commissioned six symphonies by Joseph Haydn, which he conducted himself. He wrote string quartets, concertos, symphonies, and operas, which were performed at Paris's Palais Royal. He had money, fame, and social standing. But the coming French Revolution would change everything.
For a lot of his life, he was friends with the aristocracy, and so really he owed a lot of his prosperity to the monarchy. And yet when it came down to it, he decided to side with the revolution.
And come the revolution, a legion, a black legion, is organized.
Le Chevalier led 800 infantrymen and 200 cavalry against France's enemies. It came to be known as the Légion Saint-Georges. He fought alongside General Thomas Alexander Dumas, the father of the great novelist Alexander Dumas. Like Le Chevalier, the Dumas were black.
Le Chevalier educated Dumas' father. He educated him in swordsmanship.
Dumas the Younger must have learned about the fencing prowess of Le Chevalier from his father. Some believe that Thomas Alexander Dumas was the inspiration for Porthos in The Three Musketeers, and that Le Chevalier was the inspiration for the high-spirited and politically connected Aramis. When the French Revolutionary War ended, Le Chevalier was a hero. He and his legion had fought and defeated the Austrian army at Lille. But he was a hero only for a little while.
The French Revolution descended into this paranoid mess. You could be a good revolutionary one day, and the next day you were the enemy of the people. And so Le Chevalier, like many other people who previously had been heroes of the revolution, he was denounced, and he was in prison for a year. And he's lucky to survive, because many, many people who were arrested were just guillotined.
After his release, Le Chevalier was unable to restart his military and musical careers.
No matter how successful he was and how intellectual he was and how much of an accomplished sportsman he was, there was always this chain of race dragging behind him, that pulling him back.
Long before the revolution, Georges Bologna de Saint-Georges had returned to Guadeloupe to oversee the plantation. He died there and left his fortune to his white daughter. In the late 1790s, the Chevalier suffered a series of infections and stomach ailments. On June 12, 1799, he died of gangrene. He was poor, alone, and just 53 years old. Much of Le Chevalier's music was lost during the Revolution, and what survived was quickly forgotten. But a couple decades ago, the music world began to once again take notice of his work.
Nowadays, he's rather more famous than he used to be in France. People do recitals of his music quite a lot. A street is now named after him in Paris. So hopefully this is the beginning of a revival in interest in Le Chevalier.
The legacy of Le Chevalier de Saint-Georges is still being written. Perhaps his epitaph should be taken from a classic Three Musketeers line delivered by the literary character he may have inspired, Aramis. The merit of all things lies in their difficulty.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.